The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. Well, Boris Johnson and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison have agreed a trade deal. James, tell us about the details of what has proved to be quite a controversial debate.
Well, we don't have that many details, to be honest. It's an agreement in principle. We know that for 15 years there will be tariff rate quotas on Australian meat coming into the UK. So, in other words, you couldn't flood the market with cheap Australian meat, kind of crowding out British farmers. I personally, though, this trade deal is an odd one because I think both its proponents and its critics exaggerate its importance. Meat prices in Asia are roughly twice what they are in the UK. I think that is where Australian farmers are going to continue to kind of concentrate their export energies. I don't think this is going to have a dramatic effect on UK farmers. I think it will obviously make Scottish whiskey cheaper in Australia, Australian wine cheaper here. It is at the margins. It is a good thing. I think it's more significant in that it will help pave the way for UK membership of CPTPP, one of those things that's almost impossible to pronounce.
And what does that stand for?
The Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal of agreement of 12 countries. I think this has two particular bits of importance for the UK. One is that if you got to a situation where the WTO just could not function because of tensions between the West and China had got too great, I think that CTPP has the kind of makings of another GATT in it. Another General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which was the precursor to the World Trade Organization, set up after World War II, excluding the Soviet bloc. And the second significance is, if you talk about how the US and the UK are most likely to do a trade deal, I think it is most likely to be that the US chooses at some point in the future to join CPTPP. Donald Trump decided to take the US out of it. Joe Biden, we know, is unlikely to do anything much on trade before the midterm elections in the US. But if later on in his presidency he feels slightly more confident about that agenda, this is the obvious place agreement for the UK, for the US to join, given the China aspect of it. And so that, I think, is probably the significance of this deal. But I think that when the NFU suggests it's going to drive British farmers out of business, I think they're erroneous. I think when people suggest it's going to dramatically reduce the cost of food to British consumers, that they're also erroneous.
Fraser, our colleague Katie has written a lot about the battle within the cabinet and the wider Conservative Party between the Waitrose protectionists and the Lidl free marketeers. So who's won out in this particular trade debate?
I would proudly identify as a little free marketeer. I'm a little open to near my house, and it's great going there, seeing all the food from around the world that the British supermarkets unfortunately don't stock as much of. But I don't expect to see much from Australia there anytime soon. I mean, the fact that, unfortunately, there's been a compromise between the Waitrose protectionists and little free marketeers, and this is a deal which is going to be phased in over, like, 10, 15 years. It's going to be a long time before we start to see the full effect of this, and those full effects are going to be quite small, really. So politically, it's funny, I was reading this article from the Australia's Tourism and Trade Minister right now about how this is going to be great and abolish borders between our two countries and lead to proper coordination. I mean, good luck to anybody wanting to go to Australia right now. The place is sealed off. It's sealed off to Australians, let alone to Brits. And those things, to me, are such bigger obstacles to overcome than the fact that we might be able to get some cut price sugar for a while. So I think this is politically significant, perhaps, but I think it pales into far less significance when we look at the worldwide protectionism about to go up after COVID. But we're not free to travel, and that will certainly, in fact, trade. And we, you know, ironically, we might end up doing less trade with Australia than we did even before Brexit. We haven't, you know, right now, in New Zealand, people talk about the terror of New Zealand lamb coming in to put British hill farmers out of business. But we don't even use the quota, the tariff-free quota of New Zealand lamb right now. So these things loom politically larger than they are in real life. Now, you know, I supported Brexit, but I would never really thought that free trade deals are going to be that much of a game changer. Over the last 40, 50 years, we've seen the tariffs for global free trade, in other words, the trade with America, that's come down to pretty low levels. You can knock a couple of percentage points off that. You can knock a few quotas out of the way. But I don't think fundamentally you're going to have that much change. And the funny thing about Lidl is actually the ingenuity and the innovation of retailers like Lidl and retailers like Costco that are going to bring us food from other parts of the world at lower prices. I don't think the trade barriers are the biggest problem. I mean, looking around as a global free trader, as a classic kind of old-fashioned Adam Smith liberal, I see barriers to the movement of goods and people all over the world right now. And free trade deals, even slow-motion 10, 15-year free trade deals, aren't going to be much help in the short term.
And James, this is a positive piece of news on trade following weeks and weeks of arguments over the impact of the post-Brexit EU-UK trade deal on Northern Ireland. But on matters related to the union, the SNP are hoping to exploit the farming aspect of the Australian trade deal. Do you think that they're going to be able to continue with that now? Ian Blackford has got very angry, well, he always gets angry about everything, in the House of Commons about it in recent Prime Minister's questions.
I think that the impact that you will actually see will be less than expected. I also think one of the things that will make life slightly more difficult for the SNP is that who do they want to do trade deals with? I mean, it does seem at the moment the SNP are almost opposed to trade deals with absolutely anybody. And I think there is a tricky aspect here for the SNP, because the EU is currently trying to negotiate a deal with Australia. And we know that the SNP wants to take Scotland back into the EU. In this protectionist turn, are they going to oppose that if the EU were to come to a trade deal with Australia? I think the other thing as well is that I think the government have become more sensitive to this point. You know, notice the emphasis on the benefits of Scots whisky and other Scottish products from this deal.
Fraser, moving on to the announcement made by Boris Johnson last night that COVID restrictions would be extended beyond the 21st of June. There's been more fallout today from Conservative MPs who are worried that the government doesn't want us to learn to live with COVID. Where do you think the debate is going to go next?
I think the struggle is between Boris Johnson, fundamentally liberal on these things, and his advisers, who certainly I think the Prime Minister regards many of them as people who are going to spend the rest of their lives wearing masks. And I think there is a common sense compromise to wait to see how the Delta variant is shaping up. And Public Health England released some figures last night, and one of them was showing the ratio of hospitalizations to infections. And as Ross Clark points out in an article for Coffee House, that ratio is coming down, which suggests that the Delta variant is less likely rather than more likely to put you in hospital. Now, is that the case, or is it simply because it's more likely to infect young people than older people? There is still a while to go now before we see the figures. I'd say right now there's a sort of 20% chance that Delta variant is quite significantly nastier than the other variants and could lead to a far worse scenario than we'd thought. In 2 or 3 weeks' time, we should know if that's the case or not. The big question is what happens then, and I think that's what the MPs are worrying about. The Prime Minister has said it will be a terminus, his words. In other words, there will not be another extension. Of course, we all know what he said about not wanting to abolish Christmas. And there's so many other quotes where he has had to go back on his word here. And there is concern, understandable concern, that he is not in control, that the sage advisors are in control, and that there will always be a new variant, there will always be doubt to eradicate, always be an excuse to keep people locked up. Right now, I'm prepared to give him the benefit of a doubt, but I think that a lot of politicians aren't. And I think you really can see it this time. There's a lot more reaction against it. There have been some pretty ugly demonstrations out in Downing Street over this. You're getting a far more caustic press response, and far more MPs seem willing to speak out about this than were doing so, for example, when the current lockdown was imposed in January. So I do think the political mood is changing. And I guess the big question is, and this is a question which, you know, my colleague Kate Andrews put to me, if I'm justifying this the extension of the lockdown deadline for more information, when will it be enough? What do I think clarity will look like? How are we going to know when we can be reasonably confident? And there's no answer to that. There is. You can always argue that more time is needed, more certainty is needed. Right now, I think the Prime Minister's words, terminus, his word that Michael Gove was very unwilling to defend when he was challenged about it on the radio this morning, will be the word that he's held over with his party. I'm not sure his party would tolerate another extension to this. I think they more or less would accept the 21st of June, but not another one. And I think between now and then, we can expect to see a lot more politicians saying to the Prime Minister that we will absolutely not go along with you if you delay this again.
Finally, James, Joe Biden is preparing for a meeting with Vladimir Putin tomorrow. What can we expect that to look like?
Well, I mean, Joe Biden wanted to use the G7 summit and the NATO summit to kind of basically garner a kind of united Western response to take to this meeting with Putin in Geneva tomorrow. And I think what you can see is him trying to say that he's not going to give Putin a chance to grandstand, so there'll be no joint press conference at the end or anything like that. But I think he is going to kind of convey a message about the fact there will be consequences for Russian behaviour. Now, we see a whole variety of Russian behaviour. And some of it is classic state action. Others is kind of grey zone. You know, for example, organised crime groups based in Russia hacking into Western companies and the like. And I think what you will see from Biden is an attempt to tell Putin that, you know, there is prepared to be kind of concerted pushback from the West on this front. And if Russia kind of continues to try and spread disinformation and destabilise Western societies. I think, as always with Putin, the kind of challenge is saying these things to him is easy. Actually imposing real consequences on him, if Russia continues with this behaviour, that is where it gets more difficult. The Biden administration has already decided that essentially it can't stop Nord Stream 2 because that would involve picking too much of a fight with Germany, an important European ally. Although there is a kind of rumour that the kind of quid pro quo for that, which will be announced when Merkel visits Washington, is more explicit German support for Ukraine as part of that. But I think this will be a test of Biden's ability to get results. You know, has all of this diplomatic legwork that he has put in Cornwall, at NATO, is that going to bear fruit? Will Putin think differently about carrying on with his behaviour, facing a far more united West than he has before, and facing someone far less prepared to indulge him than Donald Trump was?
Isabel, before we sign off, and James has managed to get away without saying what he thinks about the extension to lockdown, given that yours truly has been pilloried all weekend by pretty much every listener of this podcast, agrees with Kate Andrews and disagrees with me, fair enough. But what about you, James?
I think that I think I would like to have seen a little bit more emphasis placed on this 2-week review. But I personally am with you on the case for more information. And I also think this. I think that the Public Health England study that came out yesterday afternoon showing that both the AstraZeneca and Pfizer vaccines are over 90% effective against hospitalisation after 2 doses, I think does change the calculation and give you more confidence that if you can give everyone in those priority groups 1 to 9 their second vaccine, that is a more manageable situation to deal with. I also thought it was interesting that Michael Gove went out of his way on the radio this morning. I think I'm right in saying that yesterday there were a kind of single figure number of deaths reported. Michael Gove went out on the radio this morning to say that, you know, look, even if there are kind of hundreds of deaths a day, the government could live with that in terms of lifting restrictions. And I think this is the kind of part of an effort to persuade Tory MPs who are worried that, you know, that July 19th really is it. I also think there is an argument you need to have your exit, what you want to have your exit wave in the summer rather than when the NHS is under more pressure in the autumn. So I think that the 19th of July should be the final point. And I think if the data suggests that the link between cases and hospitalisations really has been broken when it's reviewed in 2 weeks' time, I think they shouldn't be afraid to move the unlocking forward.
It seems to be a complete mess of communication, though. I mean, even right now, your average Tory MP, I've been speaking to a few of them today, they've got no idea what the metrics the government are going to be looking at. Data, not dates. But I mean, that has not been the story this year, right? It's been the data being way better than anybody expected, but the dates stayed exactly the same.
I personally think the key point, which the government is kind of almost said, but not totally said, should be we should be told what percentage of the population need to be fully vaccinated for the government to be confident that a full reopening would be safe.
Right, and right now they're going to do all the over 50s by the end of this month, double vaccinated, right? So that's as fast as you can want. But you know right now, I mean, you're right in saying our lefts are low, lowest in Europe, but our cases are now the highest in Europe. Now, when you look at that, every day I look on the Spectator Data website and look at this, and today when I saw that, there is no doubt this would certainly give me pause. I mean,
ultimately, the point of the vaccine should be to make us less concerned about cases.
Yes, exactly. But right now we're programmed, we're tuned to seeing high cases and thinking, okay, that means there's trouble around the corner. Now, perhaps there's not. Perhaps that game has been completely changed by the science. But
I mean, I think the other thing as well I'm struck by is in the modelling that was released as kind of background yesterday, just how broad the estimates are. I thought, you know, that you can almost look at that modelling and the confidence interval is so wide, the different scenarios are so wide. I thought Francois Belou of UCL was quite interesting. He said, look, you look at this, you know, you could almost pick any course of action based on the modelling because the confidence interval is so wide. But I think in this situation, I mean, that they're probably... Now, there is a case for waiting for more information for acting. But it is interesting, we are all accepting, and I will acknowledge this, that we are all accepting that, well, as previously I think we would have thought with depriving the kind of these kind of restrictions, that the evidence would have to be on the side of the restrictions. We are now asking for the evidence to be on the side of the unlocking. I accept that case. So I just think having gone through as much and as long a set of restrictions as the country has, I think waiting to ensure that you have double vaccinated those people most at risk, those groups 1 to 9, I can see the rationale and logic for.
If only Kate Andrews were here to get stuck into you.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening.